Friday, April 5th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Today's 4.8 magnitude earthquake, or as they call 4.8 in California, an earth nudge or earth scooch, did have one tragic downside for residents. No one made any money off it. Not so for Monday's natural phenomenon, which can be much better planned for, as local newscasts clearly have.
And a reminder, 19 News is hosting Lights Out in the Land with the Lake Erie Crushers. It's a family-friendly event, and we would love for you to join us. It's from 11:30 in the morning till 4:30 p.m. Just go ahead and scan that QR code on your screen for tickets.
The Cleveland station rebranding the eclipse is Lights Out in the land as in Cleveland. Even as the sun is untimely cleaved from the sight of those on the ground, could have gone in that direction. Yeah, a little more of a roundabout way to get there. Okay, Lights Out in the Land is fine. Other stations had their own branding.
The facility is throwing what it's calling a solarbration for all the residents.
They were positively giddy in Dallas, where the Lights Out in the Land, or solarbration, offers a chance for the old to feel young, or at least sling the lingo of the Utes.
All right, so here we go. Tens of thousands of people are expected to visit the Metroplex next week to view the total solar eclipse in totality. Hello, I'm Steve Eager.
You just like the word totality.
I love totality.
Hello, everybody. It is totes, exactly. I'm Heather Hayes.
That is Fox 4 Dallas, near but not in the path of totality. Well, here's Fox's Austin affiliate sending a reporter 2 hours west to Fredericksburg, Texas, which is right in that path of totality.
The Visitors Bureau says as of Friday afternoon, hotels are 65% booked, short-term rentals are 85% booked, and RV parks are 100% booked. Those numbers could change as the day gets closer.
Probably by increasing, I would say that's the change that they could expect, not in the case of the maxed out RV parks. But let's say RVs are too upscale for you. How about just showing up in some guy's yard? Well, Fox 7 found that guy, and his plans seem spectacularly ill-considered.
Ross Suber put his property up on Facebook Marketplace after his friends suggested it. He's never rented out the 10-acre property before, and it's going to be trial and error.
We don't have power set up for folks yet, and we don't have sewer set up for folks yet, so I need to be conscious of that.
Sounds like a walking nightmare, although with an eclipse could seem more like a nighttime nightmare. I've been checking in with the good people of Indiana, specifically the metropolis of Kokomo, from time to time, as I do. This is my normal course of things, but their newscast got especially relevant, and they told us what local landmarks are in the path of totality and which don't totally get into the path of totality.
Kokomo Speedway? No totality. Indiana University Kokomo? Totality. Downtown Kokomo? No totality. Kokomo High School? Barely totality.
Kind of thought the whole idea of totality was an either was or wasn't thing. I did not know you could have a little bit of totality. But that is why you tune to WTHR Channel 13 to learn and also to glance at some of the other news, which makes me realize why this eclipse is such a welcome break for viewers, for reporters, for perhaps the sun itself. Here are the other top stories right now on that news site. 15-year-old found dead in retention pond on Indy's northwest side. Dorsey, sentenced to time served for killing IMPD officer, gets 25 more years for attempted murder of girlfriend. Suspect in Randolph County rape, human trafficking, child exploitation case escapes overseas after posting bond. 35-year-old Avon Mann killed in I-70 crash near Greenfield. Many, many people in the news reports I watched called this eclipse depolarizing, a perfect solution for our polarized times, they said. They noted the eclipse is a welcome break for so much of the trouble in the world. They compared the joy of the eclipse to the ongoing wars and calamities of domestic politics. Bring on the eclipse, I say. We need something to blot out not just the sun, but so much of what it illuminates down here. On the show today, so yesterday, I talked about struggling podcasts. Well, today, I shall try to elevate a very interesting one. Jenna Martin is a pathologist and the host and creator of the Memory Hole podcast. Talks about the recovered memory, let's call it movement, from the late 80s and the early 90s. She was a bystander Now she's a researcher, and as I said, an expert. We're going to dedicate the whole show to this fascinating interview based on a fascinating podcast. Jenna Martin up next. I discovered a really, really fascinating podcast. I think I can't even remember how I came across it. I think a listener of another podcast who I was CC'd on said, you got to listen to The Memory Hole. And so I listened to The Memory Hole, and it was a revelation. It's put together by Jenna Martin, who we're going to find out about her. And what it does is it contemplates recovered memory or false memory syndrome or theory, which was quite the cultural obsession when Jenna was younger. She's almost exactly the same age as I am. I have been covering and paying attention to the consensus on recovered memory syndrome, and I pretty much thought that it was a discredited pseudoscience, but, and I learned from the podcast, it's made something of a comeback, and Jenna examines all of this. We're going to find out about her and about recovered memory. Welcome to The Gist, Jenna.
Thank you for having me, Mike.
How'd you get into the subject?
Well, I was, during the pandemic, taking a writing class, you know, nonfiction essay writing, and one of the prompts was about shame. And it just sort of came to me immediately, these memories that I had of me in college in about 1989. And the memory that I had at that time was I walked into my college apartment and I forgot what I was going to say. I was talking to my roommates and I kind of laughed and I said, oh, I don't remember what I was going to say. And one of my roommates said, oh, Jenna, that's a sign of abuse. And so that was, for me, I remembered, gosh, there was that crazy time when I was 18, 19, maybe extending as far as when I was 20, when everybody I knew was really searching for hidden memories. They were all convinced that they had been abused as children and just forgotten about it. So they spent a lot of time in my apartment sort of excavating their memories.
Yeah. And I think I'm 1 or 2 years younger than you. So I was in high school watching all this play out on Oprah Winfrey and not having the people actually tell me that there are repressed memories, but seeing it as this social phenomenon. And Oprah Winfrey played a big role in all this, didn't she?
That's right. Yeah. A lot of people forget some of the main characters that we see even now in popular culture, like Oprah. She herself came forward with revelations that she had been abused as a child by a cousin. And then there were other celebrities too, like Roseanne Barr. She's had many incarnations, and one of them in 1991 was as an incest survivor. And years later, she then said she completely regretted that. It was really, she says it was one of the worst decisions she ever made, which I sort of feel like for Roseanne is saying a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Oprah hosted a lot of incest survivors on her show during daytime television. It was kind of a regular topic of conversation.
So you spend many episodes figuring out the answer to this next question that I'm going to ask you to summarize in a couple. But what is the truth, let's just say right now, the state of the best expertise on thinking about how frequent recovering repressed memories actually happens versus how popular it was for a time in the culture?
Yeah, well, that was kind of the way I started out my thinking about all this, like, are repressed memories true? But I talked to several experts, really, who got me to go back a step and even just examine, you know, what does it mean when we say repressed? And one of the things that I thought was interesting to contemplate, you know, as a writer, just to think that really the word repression is just a metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
We're not describing like a function of a neuron, you know, tucking away a memory. We're really just using our own language capacities to try to describe this really complicated thing that we loosely understand called consciousness.
Right, right. So the Greeks thought these kind of thoughts literally existed in something they called the ether. And as you point out, it's not that there's this physical idea in the brain. Somehow we conjure these ideas and then we come up with analogies. And as you, I think, pretty expertly point out in the podcast, the analogies are often tied to the latest technology. So we might think of the brain as a computer, but when Freud was developing theories, repression was all about hydraulics, the latest science at the time. So you repress some water and then it shoots up somewhere else. So this is the concept that was very much in the ether, to borrow the Greeks' phrase, about how memory worked and was playing out in especially the minds of a lot of young women in the culture in the 1990s.
Right, right. And so one of the experts I talked to was an English professor, Dr. Frederick Cruz, who's really famous in the memory wars era from the 90s. And he, you know, really reminded me, you know, you can't prove a negative. So you can't say that a repression is not true as a mental sort of a pattern. So all we can do in terms of proving repression or not proving repression is to talk to experts who've examined the science without a particular bias. And from their studies, I talked to a legal memory expert in Belgium and the Netherlands, Dr. Henry Akkar, and he says there's really no evidence to suggest that repression exists, that right. Our brains don't hide memories from ourselves. I think that's a very common understanding of how our memories work.
Right. So we've all had the experience of not remembering something and then someone reminds us and then the memory becomes clear. But the problem with that is the memory becoming clear or is it the suggestion of the quote unquote reminder?
Right. Yes. And really that is true. The way questions are asked of, you know, in a medical or psychological setting of patients, but even just in conversation, the way things are introduced to us, we're all sort of frighteningly suggestible.
Yeah. And so when we say it's not true, it's unlike amnesia, right? Amnesia has become this trope in fiction, a lot of bad soap operas. The person has amnesia and they forget who they are. Now, amnesia does exist in limited forms, nowhere near the prevalence that the guiding light would have us believe. But you're saying, or these experts have told you, that the idea of repressed memory is fiction. It's just pure fiction. It's an idea about an idea that's actually a bad idea.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. We forget a lot of things. And then when we remember them, it seems sort of surprising, you know, but the idea that, in particular, there's this idea about traumatic memories being different than everything else that we remember or forget, you know. And so if you've been in like a car accident, you know, you have a different memory of that moment. You know, there's lots written about the fragmentary, distressing nature of traumatic memories. I mean, I think soldiers would probably be the best studied example of that. But one of the common misconceptions in popular culture that still persists today, and I think it really got its start in the memory wars, is the idea that our brains, the natural response to trauma is to forget. And that really couldn't be farther from the truth.
Mm-hmm. And so as part of your series, you talked about, you chronicled some of the victims of the memory wars, people who were accused of things that didn't happen because of false memories. How prevalent was that?
Gosh, I don't have the statistics at my fingertips, but there were many famous cases of mostly men, fathers, uncles who were accused of accused and found guilty based only on recovered memory evidence. There was actually a famous case that was written about in the New Yorker, Paul Ingram in Washington State. His daughters accused him. And then he said, well, gosh, maybe I repressed it and sort of confessed. It was all a really terrible moment, really, for our legal system.
Yeah. Was there a great unwinding about these convictions, or in general, did the theory of repressed memories just lose credence and therefore in the courts, you know, fewer and fewer cases were brought because of them?
Well, I think starting... you used the phrase in the beginning introduction about false memory. So that really comes from the False Memory Foundation, which I talk about in the podcast. And that was a group started mostly of, I think the NIDAS was of accused parents trying to understand what had happened when this tragedy really struck their families. And they gathered a lot of experts, and I think they were really part of the unwinding of the recovered memory movement. They generated the term false memory as kind of a syndrome and popularized that. And the unwinding, I think, happened kind of gradually, such that by the early 2000s, a lot of experts like Dr. McNally from Harvard, they really felt that this era was over. You know, the American Medical Association, the American Psychological Association, they all issued statements casting doubt on the veracity of repressed memory.
And another really interesting thing about the podcast is not only do you chronicle the facts of what happened and the costs of what happened, but you get into, and this was your way in, was thinking about how it happened with you. What societally, what was in the zeitgeist to make this idea take hold? And what conclusions did you come to about that?
Oh, boy. Okay. Let's think here. So, I mean, I think one of the things for me was I was insecure, not confident, susceptible. You know, I wanted to fit in. I think like most American teenagers, and I could probably say specifically a lot of American girls, you know, feel that way. So I was really susceptible to the kind of glamour that my roommates had, you know. So when they said, it seemed like they had this big secret, you know, that they knew that everybody really was hiding all these things. And, you know, now as an adult, you look back and you think, well, how could there be this group of girls and they all just randomly got together and remembered memories of abuse? But then you think, clearly, you know, we were influencing each other. So I think I was particularly susceptible at that moment. But what was happening all around us, it was a very common idea. The Courage to Heal is a book that I talk about in some great depth in the podcast. And that was published in 1988. So that was really what sparked a lot of the popularized interest in repressed memories. And it really
that's
gave...
by Ellen Bass and Lauren Davis. And good writers.
Laura Davis.
And you took a course from them and you like them.
Oh, I didn't take a course, but a woman that I interviewed who
someone in the memory hole. Yes.
Yeah. Maybe on your radar in the future is she's a fun investigative journalist from Los Angeles, Carrie Poppy. But she has gone and taken writing courses with Laura Davis, and they both are very nice people, I'm sure, but they're creative writing instructors. And so they really believe that writing, which is, you know, essentially free and accessible to everybody, writing in a journal is a way to access memories. And that seems like a benign idea, but it's kind of could have unintended consequences. I mean, there's no science behind that, you know, writing with your non-dominant hand, sort of trying to access your quote unquote inner child through writing. And the book really guides women through these exercises and really encourage the readers of this very influential self-help book to just believe that they had been abused and then maybe act as if, and that would be liberating.
Yeah, I've had Bessel van der Kolk on the show, and he actually floored me with some of his theories about Gaza, as it turns out. But he was one of the main progenitors of these ideas, right?
Yeah, he. So the repressed memory epidemic really was all about, really focused on women. And so it had a somewhat more narrow and kind of shocking scope. And so in that case, some of the kind of more behind the scenes professors and doyens of trauma research would be like Judith Herman. She wrote a very influential book called Trauma and Remembering. I think that most fiction writers in the US seem to have their plot lines drawn from her book. You know, repression is a very useful tool then if your protagonist forgets something and then remembers it in the middle of the book. So I think that's one way the idea has been popularized. But Judith Herman would have been very influential with the kind of Courage to Heal milieu. But then Bessel van der Kolk rose out of that same era. And all of these trauma-interested psychologists and psychiatrists really gravitated to the International Society for Trauma and Dissociative Identities, mm-hmm. which still exists. And I'm sure Dr. van der Kolk's involved with that group.
So I've had both of them. I've had Judith Herman and Bessel van der Kolk on the show. And I think with this, I've interviewed both of them before. Read The Memory Hole, but I've read a lot and done a lot of research on this. And I came to believe that the state of thinking about this by the experts was that the phenomenon really didn't exist. It's been discredited. They tried to, I knew about some of the experiments you talk about. They tried to prove that any of these repressed memories, recovered memories, actually did happen. And they either found out they didn't happen or they weren't really recovered, that the people had been talking about this for a while and kind of came to define just a memory as a recovered memory. Fine. But, you know, they're both affiliated in some way with, I think, Harvard. I mean, maybe Bessel van der Kolk trained at Harvard and doesn't, or he works in the Cambridge area. But I know Judith Herman is still on the faculty at Harvard. And so it seemed to me, but you tell me, that the state of affairs with, you know, do we credit recovered memory? It's not like global warming, where there are, you could find some experts saying it doesn't occur, but the academy and 90-something percent of the experts will really chastise you if you're a global warming denier. When it comes to the recovered memory crowd, they're still allowed to operate and have a lot of credence within even the experts who define what's real and what's not. Is that how things are going now?
Yeah, I would say so. I think this is really because I think, you know, psychology, and I'm not a psychologist, but psychology really is a kind of a soft science. And I think a lot of what these people are saying kind of intuitively makes sense to people, you know, because memory is hard to understand. It's easy to take kind of an expert interpretation. And I do think kind of like back in the early 90s, there are a lot of incentives now to be a victim. And so if someone tells you that you're, you know, the pain that you feel is caused by trauma in your past, you know, maybe that's appealing to accept that definition.
Yeah. I also think that, and this is in your podcast, that we had just begun grappling with how prevalent child sexual abuse was. And for many years, decades, it wasn't talked about, and therefore people didn't think it existed. And there were very, very few prosecutions. And so as that was coming out into the open, it dovetailed with the idea of recovered memory. And one part of that could be true, that we were, as a society, not grappling sufficiently with the prevalence of child sexual abuse, whereas the other thing that went with it, and so there's so much recovered memory that will lead to evidence that there was child sexual abuse, that part was not true.
Oh, absolutely. There, and I did want to devote most of the second episode to that point, because I really, as much as I disagree with kind of the pseudoscientific, you know, a non-evidence-based approach, it there really was a lot of truth and kind of righteous anger that a lot of these feminist researchers like Judith Herman brought to the field. You know, I took a look back at just how prevalent incest was and just how kind of, I won't go so far as to say accepted, but it was just really a topic that nobody wanted to talk about. One of the people that I talked to for the podcast was my mom, who was a social worker in the 1950s and 60s. And she had many cases of children that she removed from the home and, you know, effectively punished because they had come forward claiming that a father or stepfather was sexually abusing them, and then they were put into a foster home or even psychiatric care. So there was no societal avenue to deal with this until feminists came along and kind of broke open the conversation. So all those things were necessary and long overdue, But those women had never forgotten about what happened to them. They had always remembered it, but they hadn't discussed it openly.
We'll be back with more of Jenna Martin after the break. And we're back talking with Jenna Martin, who is the host and producer of the Memory Hole podcast. So we talk a lot about the memory wars. Now, there are a lot of wars where no one really can define who the victor was, or the vanquished holds on and defines their piece of territory as the real place. Is there consensus on who won the memory wars? Are there still salvos calling into question the victors in the memory wars, or the uneasy truce after the memory wars?
Oh, yeah. You know, I think I may have said this a little bit earlier, but I do think that in the early 2000s, people thought that the kind of the false memory syndrome foundation, strictly scientific researchers had kind of, I guess, quote unquote, won the war. That would be people like Elizabeth Loftus or even the legal psychologist that I spoke to, Dr. Akar. But I would say really in the teens, you know, and one theory I have is that this has been kind of re-provoked by the Me Too era, which was that there has been a real resurgence and an increased desire to believe in some of these women's accounts. So one of the stories from the real, the memory wars, and a family I talk about in brief in the podcast is the Fried family. So that was a family where there were allegations of abuse by the then adult daughter, who herself was a psychologist. I think she was newly a psychologist then, and she's a pretty well-known psychologist now, Dr. Jennifer Fried. She went into therapy in the early 90s. It's unclear what happened during that therapy session, and then came out accusing her father, who was an academic, of incest. So her mother in particular, who's really who a lot of who did the legwork to form and run the False Memory Syndrome Foundation. But then on the opposite side to that, Jennifer Fried really devoted her whole life to kind of proving the psychological, you know, researching and proving the veracity of repressed memory. She's written books called Betrayal Trauma, you know, postulating that traumatic memories by in the home might be processed even yet differently than like a car accident or memories of war. And I know that, you know, around the Me Too era, I first heard of the, it's called DARVO, which is something that if you're accused of something, then you will deny, attack, reverse victim and offender. So this is something if women, you know, say in the Me Too era, make an accusation, then and the man denies it, then they say, oh, DARVO, you know.
It's classic DARVO. Yes, exactly. Ah, that's what's going on is DARVO. And I've on my show said, here's the problem. Actually, falsely accused people will engage in that most of the time.
Right.
If you didn't do it, you deny it. If someone's saying you did some, if someone's falsely accusing you, you might attack them. And if someone is falsely accusing you, aren't they the bad guy? Therefore, reversing victim and offender, although in your conception, and let's posit in reality, they are the offender and you are the victim. So, yeah, it just drives me crazy. It's one of those non-falsifiable logical conundrum that I don't understand how it's gotten. Well, I do understand, but it has taken on the sheen of, you know, not just respectability. Oh, this is such advanced science. You have an acronym called DARVO. It's crazy.
Yes, I have a teenager who employs this a lot, but yes. So, but that is all our inheritance from the memory wars. So, Jennifer Fried. So, I would say her star is more on the ascendant. You know, but who knows how things will reshape in a few years? You know, so
yeah.
I think those lawsuits had back in the early 90s did have a very stifling effect.
Tell me if I'm wrong about this. Was there a big New York magazine piece that either rekindled the controversy, or maybe I just read New York magazine, pointed to the fact that the controversy was rekindled?
It did. It did. And I think that may have been one of the factors that was in my mind when I first kind of got reinterested in this era, remembering my own memories of remembering. There was an article in December of 2021 in The Cut magazine from New York Magazine where she really revived Jennifer Fried's cause.
This and is Katie Heaney, I think, wrote it.
Yes, yes. And reading that, it did, and I at that time, I hadn't refreshed my mind with any of this era, and it made me wonder, really, was there this epidemic of repressed memories and incest abuse at the time? It just seemed, the article really did make it plausible.
Right. It gave a little too much credence on the, well, maybe it did happen. And I don't think it did that just as a means of raising tension or as a conceit, a journalistic conceit. I think that they were trying to say that there really was repressed memory in flying in the face of the sciences you chronicle.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and this is where it's hard to hold two things true at once. I mean, you know, that women historically, children in the home, young girls have been historically abused. And there are lots of examples of horrible cases of incest and child sexual abuse throughout history. But that doesn't mean then that every single accusation of that should be just believed without any evidence.
Yeah. So what is, I don't even know the answer to this, but I think I read some stuff on your Substack that surprised me. What's your background? You're not a journalist, professional journalist or podcaster, right?
No. I'm a pathologist. So I'm interested in memory more like in the brain structures.
Well, what kind of pathology? You're a doctor.
Yes, I went to medical school. Then I did a residency in pathology, and I actually subspecialize in dermatopathology. So I look at skin biopsies.
Right. You chronicle the discernible course of diseases through the body with markers where you could say this is happening, then that is happening. And maybe there's some area where it's like, well, it could go in either direction, but then we see how it progressed. Does the fact that that's your orientation when you looked or thought about the recovered or false memory syndrome, was there something about if you ask someone with your training to look at the quote unquote science between recovered memory, are they almost always going to say, well, this doesn't measure up to what I've defined or what my field defines as standards of proof?
You know, you could say that, but I sort of... I'm aware of some of my biases, you know, or that I have an idiosyncratic way of looking at the world. So I kind of went out of my way to read the psychological literature in good faith. But I think actually probably more, this is just my own kind of pet theory, but I think even more than being a pathologist, what makes me skeptical about a lot of psychology is that I was a history major. Mm-hmm. And I've always sort of thought of history and psychology as kind of being two different ways of looking at the world. I haven't really fleshed out this theory, but just that in the sense that, and I talk about this a little bit in the podcast, you know, you can go back, well, now over 100 years ago, but to the 1890s, Freud was tossing around these same ideas. And I just think it's very interesting that if we consider humanity throughout history, you know, what happens to our psychology in different cultural moments? I think there's a huge influence on our psychology from those around us, from kind of the ethos in the air. So that's, I do think that's a more of a bias probably on my part than pathology.
Yeah, I wasn't even thinking it was a bias. Bias can be good or bad. I was thinking in terms of if you're a pathologist or any many other kinds of doctors where you can really chronicle the course of a discernible disease, and then we name the disease, and then people in some other cultures or some other walks of life, if you say, hey, look at these genetic markers or look at where the cancer cells have grown, they would say, oh, yes, that is the disease. We got it. There's no debating that. Whereas with psychology, it's not as if you know there are processes in the mind that are just not empirical or discernible. And so you have to come up with it. It is a necessarily more theoretical discipline than what you do.
Necessarily, yes. This is a difference between hard academic psychologists and what we get in pop psychology, which I think is that people probably believe, reading someone like Bessel van der Kolk, that he has the same surety that I might say that if I do a test on a tumor, I can say, oh, this is definitively a metastasis from a kidney tumor or something. People really take his words at the same kind of value that, oh, if you have bulimia or you have a feeling of discomfort when you visit your doctor or whatever the symptoms, quote unquote, that you're feeling in the moment, that reflects a specific past trauma. I think people make the same equation between hard science and pop psychology.
Jenna Martin is the host and creator of the podcast Memory Hole. Go down it. I recommend it. Thank you, Jenna.
Thank you, Mike.
The Gist is produced by Corey Wara, producer, Joel Patterson, senior producer, Michelle Pesca spearheads our special projects division. To advertise, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Doom-peru-gee-peru-doo-peru. Thanks for listening.